And welcome to In the Moment Tech Radio for this beautiful Friday. Featuring the computer guys, I'm your host, Kent Osborne. We've gathered the experts to talk tech today and answer your questions and talk about the headlines, of course. In the studios of KCSD in Sioux Falls, we have Mac Guru Joel Brovelite and Exigent Chief Security Officer Amos Aesop. And on the line from our bureau in Pierre, of course, Jeff Litterick. Hello, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Good to have you with us today. You ask the questions, we provide the answers. If you're a Facebook aficionado, that page is simply facebook.com/techradio. You may post your questions or comments there as well. Don't be shy. Our phone number is 800-524-3604. Twitter users can send questions to @KentSDPB. And, of course, the email address that you know and love, inthemoment@sdpb.org today. inthemoment@sdpb.org. Well, Amos, I'm going to start with you today. We had another round of ransomware. There's been a couple this week. Started off in Europe. We've talked about ransomware on the show, so I'm assuming we don't really need to go into the details of what that's about. And maybe we want to recap that a little bit. But basically, a takeover of your computer, a threatening note, an encrypted system that you typically can't get through. You may have lost your data unless you give up money. That's what the ransomware is.
Sure.
Have you seen any impact locally or heard any stories about companies or anything in the Sioux Falls or Rapid City or in South Dakota?
Yeah, we have actually. There was a number of customers who had users who got this in one way or another. They're still kind of investigating that as to what it was that they did to get this. There's still some question as to how this is spreading, whether it was via email, which was kind of the initial thought. That's mm-hmm. kind of the go-to, a phishing sort of email. Here, click on this link, and you end up someplace that you probably don't want to be. And then end up getting some software like the WannaCry. WannaCry is the name of this particular. There's some variants as well. Some interesting things about this one. So recap real quick. This sort of software encrypts your hard drive, requires a ransom, in this case $300, to decrypt your hard drive, and then away you go. So in general, most of the time, in fact, every time that I know about, when you pay the ransom, you get the decryption key in order, to get your files back. And there's a reason for that. The bad guys don't want to get the reputation that if you pay that ransom that you still don't get access to your files, because that's going to cause people to be reluctant to pay that ransom, especially or even if they're in serious need of getting it back. So there's kind of a honor amongst thieves thing going on there where if they get the money, then they're actually going to provide it. Well, the problem here is it sounds like this was maybe a little more amateurish and not well planned out, and that there are a lot of folks who are paying the ransom and are not getting their decrypted files back. If you follow these folks on Twitter or anything, they're talking about how their customer service is attempting to keep up with the inflow of Bitcoin and trying to get those decryption keys out as quick as they can. But there were apparently some glitches in the system that kept the automated part from working as far as getting those decryption keys out. So
So their customer service couldn't scale up to what they needed it to.
Well, that's right. And that's really what it came down to, a customer service sort of skill. And this being the largest sort of event like this that we've seen so far, there are some scaling problems when it comes to that. And especially if when you roll out that ransomware, if there's not an automated system to send back that decryption key and somebody's got to do it manually, well, then it's difficult to keep up with and difficult to understand who you've sent it to and who you haven't and who's paid and who hasn't and so forth.
Right. So today was kind of the deadline. I guess if I'm reading this correctly, you had 3 days at the $300 level, and then the amount of payment was supposed to go up. You're supposed to act quickly, and if you didn't, your ransom payment went up to $600, and if you didn't do it by today or the end of today, then They say that they're going to lock it down for good, although there may be, you know, chances for folks that can't afford to pay or other things to, you know, win a lottery or something, I don't know, in 6 months. I didn't quite get that part of it. But so today was kind of the day at the $600 or the 600 Bitcoin level, I should say. I shouldn't use the word dollars. Bitcoin level. Or $600 worth of Bitcoin,
right,
I guess.
Right.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. 600 Bitcoin would be a tremendous amount of money.
Yeah.
But that, and that's actually part of the problem, right? Is that the people who are getting these messages, Bitcoin is well, not an impossible currency to use. It's not a intuitive currency to use. It's not something you can store in your physical wallet, in your back pocket, or in your purse. And so sometimes there's some difficulty in actually finding how do I get Bitcoin? How do I transfer my cash or my check or even money in my bank account to Bitcoin and send it off? And so, you know, there's some difficulty there in just the understanding on how to pay the ransom. And then, you know, but there's really no other way for them to do it because of the difficulty. They don't want to be caught, so they need this ability to keep these transactions semi-anonymous.
One of the interesting things about this that I learned, I guess, about Bitcoin was those accounts are all public. All Bitcoin
right.
accounts are public. I didn't know that.
Right.
So we are able to track the three deposit accounts that this money flows into and how much is there. So you can kind of track how many people are actually paying this. And it doesn't look like a whole lot of people are doing it. Compared to the infection rate,
if you take the infection rate and multiply it out by what you would expect to see from a return on investment sort of thing, it's not very high. I mean, it's the last I saw it was still under $100,000, which, based on the amount of infections, you would think it to be much higher than that. But you know, people for it could be a couple of reasons. One, people either are doing a good job in keeping their information backed up the way they're supposed to. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about the 3-2-1 rule, which is three copies on two different media, one always being off-site. That actually would protect you from this because you get the ransomware, you don't care, you wipe your computer and you restore it from your backup files and, easy peasy, it's all done. So maybe people are doing that. The other option would be maybe it's not worth the $300 of the data that they've lost, or maybe people just don't understand, how to pay that Bitcoin, or people are holding out hoping that somebody is going to come up with a solution that doesn't require the payment, which probably won't happen.
Wouldn't it be nice if it was people that actually had their systems backed up and just wiped the computer and put a new one on? Wouldn't that be nice? Jeff, did you have something?
Yeah, actually, as of today, yes, you can download a program that will de-encrypt and restore all your files on most versions of Windows, if not all. The tool actually came out first for Windows XP due to a flaw in the way the ransomware was written a couple of days ago, and now they have modified it as of today for Windows 7, Windows 2003, Windows XP, of course, and Windows 8. Windows 10 was never really a problem. So there is now actually a tool that's been verified that you can download to decrypt all your files. So someone has come out with a way to do that, and that's just because this ransomware, to be honest, was incredibly badly written. The exploit it used was an NSA hack, which was very well written and very robust, and that's why you had the infection rates. But the ransomware itself was actually really bad programming. So we got kind of lucky there in that case. So
kind of off the shelf variety ransomware is from what the media I've been following. So not real great on the programming.
No,
side.
Not even as good as off the shelf ransomware you could buy to do your own stuff. It had some unique features, so I didn't need network access to get encrypt keys, but it was really considered. The ransomware we're talking about has actually been out for a long time, but it never made any news or any blip because it was really poorly written. Only when it was paired with the NSA exploit, which was written very good and very robust, as we all saw in the infection rates, did it actually make any news. So, It's kind of one of those things, a MediaCorp ransomware paired with a really good exploit luckily it was so badly written that people have come up with decryptors already. So, but yes, and we can post a link to the article that links to the decryptor on the Facebook page, but it is out as of today.
How big of a deal was it that and they're calling it an accident, but it really wasn't an accident. The guy working on the malware company, a malware tech in the UK, registered a domain name, kind of associated. He noticed that this was pinging a certain web address that wasn't registered. And it's protocol for them to go ahead and register those so that they can measure traffic. They can see how big of an impact this thing is having. And by doing that, sort of turned off a part of this. How big was that?
Pretty big, actually. It really slowed down the infection rates. And that's what we call the kill switch. It's one of those things that defines this ransomware. Most ransomware does not have a kill switch. And what I'm going to describe is basically the software looked for that domain name, and if it just existed, the ransomware would stop spreading. Also, it would look for certain registry keys in the computer, and if it found them, stop spreading. So once that news got out, everyone put those registry keys in, you know, the enterprise and stuff too, to stop it. If you did get infected from spreading, and also that domain name, of course, once it was registered, acted as a kill switch. It's kind of funny in that then the antivirus programmers thought it was part of the bad part of the program and actually blocked requests, so the virus started spreading again until they caught up. They said, oh, that's the kill switch, and stopped blocking the DNS requests. So, and then, of course, one thing to remember is once that was made, the authors released a new version with a different kill switch, which was quickly found, then a new version and a new version. There's like 9-10 versions of this, all using different kill switches now, but they keep the kill switch in, which means it's always easily defeatable. That's why I'm very glad that it was a very media-core ransomware in and of itself, because if it had been written much better, it would have caused tons more grief for everybody.
And the theory right now behind that kill switch is that it's an attempt to evade what we call a sandbox. So there's a new technology that, I guess it's not new, but it's becoming more prevalent, that when new files come into your network, they get put into a sandbox environment, which is a virtual environment where you can do what we call detonating a file, which means let the file do whatever it wants, and then let's watch it and see what happens. And when you're inside a sandbox, sometimes there's a necessity to make a call to the internet, and so it will respond with a fake response so that it's not actually doing internet traffic, which is where that kill switch happened. So when it would make that call and it wouldn't get a response back, it would say, okay, that domain isn't registered and I must be on a real live computer, because if I was in a sandbox, I'd get a fake response. Well, then they fix that with a kill switch this time and then the next time. And really that's what they're attempting to do, is to evade that whole sandboxing technology that might keep it from getting into a network.
Okay. Jeff, I've got an email this morning about a company called DocuSign that got hacked. And they're, they're one of the reasons that you're supposed to be able to trust opening things on your email, isn't it?
Yeah. The exploit, and we should talk about this a little bit, was actually patched in March. So the way this spread mostly, and there was some, actually it initially got out, there was some email phishing to actually get it into the UK hospital system and stuff. Mm-hmm. I've seen some of those emails, but it was very limited. It basically, that's what started the spread. So once it got out through that email and got into a couple of networks, it started spreading wildly within them and through other people out through the internet, because it used an exploit that affected all Windows machines. And if you didn't patch in March, and this included XP machines, I mean, Microsoft actually did release a patch for XP, which is abnormal because they don't support that operating system anymore. That's how serious this exploit was. But it was patched in March. So if you had applied patches, you were pretty safe, without the register keys, without the kill switch, stuff like that. It's those organizations that didn't have good patch management, or for one reason or another, can't patch systems like X-ray machines and stuff like that because of certification issues, that will really hit hard. And that's kind of why you see a lot of hospitals, especially in the UK, being hit, because a lot of those systems are in lockdown. You cannot patch those systems without invalidating certification for healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it really took hold. And the base of the exploit was actually, we know, everyone kind of knew this was coming back in January. A group called the Shadow Brokers stole a whole bunch of exploit and hacking tools that the National Security Agency from the United States, NSA, had developed and was using. And they started threatening to spread these out and release them, which they did in April. The actual exploit was released in April to the public, so that people could use it. And actually, Shadow Brokers is now threatening, as of this week, to release even more exploit tools and stuff. Microsoft got wind of it back in February that this was coming. Everyone kind of knew it was coming. And a lot of people started turning off what we call the version that was vulnerable, because you can actually turn off the older version of SMB. And Microsoft put a patch out. So it's the people you kind of noticed who didn't have good security practices for patching, right? And if security companies don't have good internal security patching, you know, it raises red flags.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I mean, we had to take a quick break, but I just wanted to note that it just took one person to open that email to get everybody kind of in the company, right? Everybody in the company has to click on this thing to have it go down.
If the company was not patched, if they had patched their March patches, they were perfectly safe, except for the person who opened up the email.
Okay. Well, that's an important clarification, but it does give you a pretty good perspective on this. It wasn't a whole bunch of people throughout Europe clicking on it. It could have been, you know, a very limited number that spread it to.
The impression I got from the analysis we saw of those emails on the forum stuff, it was maybe 100 emails, 200 people clicking on emails total, and that's what started the whole thing. And then from there, it spread fast through the SMB exploit that we were talking about.
Sure. Well, let's talk about that when we come back from this break. We have to take a quick break, and then we'll do that. We want to let you know. You can send us an email, inthemoment@sdpb.org, or drop us a text, 956-SDPB. That's 956-7372. We'll be back with more of the Computer Guys after this. And you're in the moment on SDPB Radio. I'm Ken Osborne, and we are talking tech today. We have some folks to take your tech questions. Amos Asip is here, Jeff Litterick on the line as well. We're really talking, we've talked more about on this program, the WannaCry issue that's been up over the course of the last week, because it's a kind of a big deal. This morning, China is kind of chiming in and saying, it's kind of bad on you guys on the NSA for stockpiling exploits like this. Does China have a point?
Except that China does exactly the same thing. Probably even more stockpiling of exploits, especially considering recently, and this happened about a year ago, Microsoft gave China government access to the source code of Windows for other reasons. But we all know why, because once you have the source code, it's much easier to find holes and write exploits. So, China, every country does this, and Microsoft actually beat up on the NSA, too, about this, that they shouldn't do this for major, security holes. But I would lay a bet that every single country that has any cyber warfare program is doing exactly the same thing. And in fact, many of them may have had this exact same exploit. They were just keeping it secret so that only they could use it.
I've seen estimates that's between possibly 200 and 300 countries that could pull something off of magnitude. Is that what you've heard?
Yep. In fact, a lot of people are pointing fingers for this one at North Korea groups too. And North Korea has a very active hacking tool that goes out and as the Sony Pictures thing a couple years ago and do stuff. They're probably, them and China are actually probably the most visible in terms of hacking outside of Israel and the United States. Russia tends to downplay it, but we know they're active. They just downplay it, that they protect their hackers in the country, because Russia has a unique law that if you're a hacker in Russia, you can hack any other country except Russia, and you will never be prosecuted or extradited. You just cannot hack inside Russia itself. But if you can hack anybody else and be totally legally non-responsible as long as you remain in Russia. So they encourage it, right, through different, and have military units and civilian units and stuff. I would say in many of those countries that is listed, the United States may be, you know, only second or third in terms of activity, actually.
That's an eye-opener. Well, let's get this back a little bit back to earth here and break it down for folks. Amos, you mentioned if people have proper backups in place, they're not going to be impacted by this. We've talked about some of the ways you can back up systems in the past on this show, and maybe those are getting a little dated. I saw a lot of people touting cloud backups in the last week. That's an effective way of doing it? How do people do that? Amos, can you just break down a couple of ways that if I don't know anything about cloud computing and backing things up in the cloud, how do I get started?
Sure. So there's a couple of different ways you could do it. You know, the quickest and probably easiest is to just go out and do a Google search of cloud backup. And there's many, many services out there that will help you with this. You know, generally what happens is you download a piece of software to your computer. It will go through and you can say, these are the items I want to back up. This is how frequently I want to back them up. Or, you know, maybe even on a continuous basis. And then, you know, when we talk about backing up to the cloud is really just somebody else's computer, right? So it takes a copy of that data, encrypts it, sends it off to that other computer that hopefully is somewhere far away, geographically dispersed is what we say. And that would be for, you know, reasons such as tornadoes or floods or any other ecological disaster. But, you know, and then for a relatively inexpensive fee, you're talking maybe a couple $100s at most a year, you're going to be able to have these files that are backed up. And then in some cases, you can retrieve them from other machines. You can retrieve them from your phones or your tablets for, you know, restoration or even just viewing purposes if they're pictures or something like that. If your computer gets infected with ransomware, you don't care. You erase the entire thing. You reinstall the operating system, which generally is just a key on the keyboard when you first boot the computer, and then reinstall that software, and all your data comes flying back. And so, it's relatively inexpensive and pretty easy.
I just did what you told me to do, or told us to do, which was go out and Google cloud backup, and I see names that I've heard of here. And then I came across an article, there's 22 online backup services that are reviewed. So it's an expanding market, it appears.
It is.
But you can either read somebody else's take on it or go with a name you trust. But that's clearly one good way to do it. Has there been a backup service that's failed? Have they shuttered or had major hardware failure and it's not as good as it seems?
Well, there's, you know, a lot of these services are dependent on, they're just taking and layering on top of like AWS or Amazon's web services, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when those services become unavailable, then the service that's layered on top of it becomes unavailable. Now, I haven't heard of data that, you know, was never ever retrievable again because of the particular company going under or something like that. You know, if that were to happen, I would hope that there would be some sort of, hey, we're going to be closing our doors in the next month or whatever, and you'd have the opportunity to change to a different service. Plus, in that instance, they'd have to close and you'd have to have a catastrophe at the same time. So, you know, there would have to be a unique situation there. But there have been instances where Amazon Web Services goes down for whatever reason, whether it's a DNS reason or it's a hardware reason, and, you know, your files are not retrievable until that system is fixed and comes back.
Okay. We have a question from Kathleen Ann, and she asks, I use Linux. Talk about that as a road to hack safety. I also keep all my data on external, which is not connected a lot of the time. So So Kathleen is backing up her data and unhooking it from the systems. That's a good way to do it?
Absolutely. Yeah, if you're backing up your files, and that's the suggested route too, is depending on the ransomware, that ransomware might be looking for those connected drives. If you've got an external drive or a thumb drive or something like that, and it doesn't do you any good if those get encrypted. So when you do the backup, you're going to want to remove that that connection in order to make sure that backup is safe and secure. And ideally, you'd like to remove it off-site as well. I know that can always happen, but you know, that would protect you in case of a flood, a fire, earthquake, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. The first part of the comment is about the Linux operating system, and for folks that aren't fully aware, there is an alternative to Microsoft Windows and Apple iOS on a lot of machines, and that is a free operating system called Linux. I guess there are versions you can pay for, aren't there? Enterprise versions or whatever. But for public use, for something that I might download a disk image or something and install, it's free. It's open source. So a lot of folks have had their hands in making this. That makes it it's a much smaller subgroup of machines, and that makes it less likely that people are going to write exploits for those. Is that the case, or is she uses the word hack safety? Is there anything about Linux inherently that's more hack proof? This is my question.
Well, I think it's one of those making money in hacking computers or ransomware, that sort of stuff, is really a volume play. And so you're going to, you know, at $300, you're not going to get rich until you've got a number of those people paying for them. And so the obvious target is to go after the largest quantity of machines available that are on the same platform, which is Windows. For a long time, that gave other platforms a real sense of security, Mac especially. I think you remember the commercials where they used to say, you know, Macs can't get PC viruses. That was the one with the two comedians, and those aren't really around anymore. But you know, as those platforms come into play, they're becoming more and more susceptible because, you know, people feel comfortable using them and don't put as many safeguards in front of them generally. And so hackers are starting to see that, and they're saying, well, now there's this untapped market of these people out here who, you know, aren't even running an antivirus on maybe their Mac, or in this case, their Linux machine. So I wouldn't say your Linux machine is hacker proof. I would just say it's a smaller target. I'm sure Jeff would have a comment on that.
Yeah. And you know, this is the same of any platform though. From the past, a lot of these platforms, most people are going to go after the biggest. If you're the biggest market iOS or Android or Mac or Windows or Linux, you're going to get the most raw number of attacks. Now, Linux has the distinction of being used a ton in server environments. So most of their hacks for Linux are based off getting in through web servers, which they run, and database programs and stuff, more server-type activity than a user using it as a workstation would actually be running. But also, you still need to keep patched up. I patch, you know, our Linux stuff, you know, about twice a month, because there's always patches coming out. It's just like Windows. There's always patches. Linux patches do tend to come out faster and more ahead and before the exploits come out with better timing, so you are a little bit better that way. But don't think you still don't need to take the same precautions as you do on, say, a Windows box. There's less attacks out there, but some of those attacks are still out there, and you can't, you know, lower your defenses.
Okay. Well, we thank her for the question and the comment there. Do you think a lot of folks are going to move off to alternate operating systems after this, or are we just getting more cautious and starting to back things up more, you think?
I'll go out that, at least at the corporate level and stuff, ransomware has made so many headlines with hospitals having to pay in the United States and stuff in the past to get the files back, that I think it's made enough noise that most people are taking precautions, and your best precautions is to back up. because once you have a good backup, you can always recover, right? So it's kind of, there's always a arms race in hackers versus defenses. The hackers invented ransomware, right? Before that, they had email phishing scans with botnets, right? And before that, they had something else. As the defenses got better to stop, detect, and stop those kind of things, I mean, most organizations are really good at stopping botnets right now. You know, they move on to the next thing. It's always an arms race. As we get much better at preventing ransomware, they will move on to the next thing they hope to make money from. So it's a never-ending arms race. It has been for 20-plus years now. So it's kind of interesting to see what they will come up with next, though.
Very good. Going down the order here, I guess, we talked about backing up. The next caution that everybody uses is, make sure that link you're clicking on in your emails is coming from an actual certified, you know, it's going to be bona fide good, which is becoming a moving target in itself. We were talking about it on the last show, the whole Google Docs fiasco with people getting the emails and being infected because they were clicking on emails from colleagues. It's throwing a lot of trust issues into my email, I got to tell you guys. I'm even getting warnings from my email program saying, you know, something about this doesn't quite look right. And, so boy, can you trust any of them anymore?
Well, no is the answer.
Okay.
You really should look at everything with a little bit of skepticism, and that's going to be the best way to keep yourself secure. You know, one of the things that we push where I work at Exigent is to, if you get a link from somebody that says, hey, you got to check out this new widget or this new Facebook page or whatever it is rather than clicking on the link, which oftentimes can be disguised to show Facebook on the page but actually takes you somewhere else, is to actually type in Facebook yourself or to type in the link yourself so that you know for sure you're actually going to the legitimate site. And that's actually going to keep you away from 99% of the phishing techniques that are hiding a nefarious site behind a good looking link. And then the other thing is if it doesn't look right, if you think it's odd that somebody would be sending you a file of that type or a file with that description, always best to just either call or ask that person, hey, did you send this? Because I don't want to open it without knowing this is something you actually meant for me to get. So everything on the internet should be taken with a good dose of skepticism and making sure that it is what it actually appears to be.
I just wonder if there are groups like Public Broadcasting. We send out a number of communications on a daily basis, and I wonder if that's going to affect how we craft those messages. Maybe not so many links in business communications in the future. I'm not sure. That'll be an interesting thing to track, for sure. We do have to take another quick break. When we come back, we have a lot of news to get through, from net neutrality to some product news and other things. But we'd of course love to have your questions as well. 956-SDPB is the number you can text us at. If you'd like to call us, 800-524-3604. That's 800-524-3604, or our email address inthemoment@sdpb.org is a great way to get a hold of us, and we'll talk more tech after this quick break. And welcome back to In the Moment Tech Radio, featuring the computer guys. I'm your host, Ken Osborne. It's been a dangerous computing week, and we've got a couple of security experts on the line today. We have Jeff Litterick from the Bureau of Information and Telecommunications in Pierre, and Amos Aesop, Exigent's Chief Security Officer. Guys, thank you for being on the show. We really appreciate that. A couple of quick programming notes. The next program is June 2nd, so prepare for that if you'd care to. Our Facebook page is always open, facebook.com/techradio. We like continuing the conversation there. And then I wanted to just mention something before we got off the air today, before time got late. And if there's any folks rolling into town early in Rapid City, huge deal going on out there this weekend, the world finals of the Excellence in Computer Programming championships out in Rapid City. It was in Thailand last year, Jeff, and this year it's in Rapid City, I think, is the deal there. Anyway, the world finals sponsored by IBM going on out in Rapid City at the Rushmore Plaza Civic Center and at the RIMCOTA. A big deal, and we want to certainly send out a welcome to those folks coming in to spend an amazing several days in our state, and hope you get out and enjoy some of the Black Hills while you're here as well. It's a big opportunity and welcome, certainly. Folks listening can send your questions to the program today by emailing them in the moment at sdpb.org. And again, our 800 number, 1-800-524-3604 today. Well, guys, yesterday we saw the first march down the road to repealing some of the net neutrality limits that were put in by the Obama administration. We didn't not expect that. That's completely expected. And then it seems we're going to go into a period of public comment. And I was a little bit heartened by that. How much comment do you think the FCC is going to get on this issue? Is this going to be an off-the-chart needle thing for those folks, or do most common folks not care?
I'll just make a quick comment, and I'll let everyone else chime in. A couple of things. The Senate just introduced a bill that would basically, once the FCC repeals net neutrality, would take away the authority of the FCC to ever reinstate it again. So they're calling it the Internet Freedom Act. It's been proposed in the Senate. If you want net neutrality, that bill needs to die. Otherwise, once this happens, no other future administration will be able to actually reapply it. So that's something to keep in mind. The other thing is the comment sections are actually down and up a lot right now because they're being overloaded by spam bots against net neutrality. So be patient if you do wish to comment. The website may not always be up because it's being flooded massively by spam bots the FCC is complaining about. But do comment. I mean, if you're serious about this issue, please comment on it.
And again, just to get to the heart of the issue, we've talked about it quite a bit on the show, but we'll go into it a little bit more. Under the net neutrality policy, providers can't block or slow down consumers' internet traffic or charge websites a fee in order to be displayed on consumers' screens, that type of thing. It also empowers the FCC to investigate ISP practices risk harming competition. So that's been a big part of this as well. The companies bristle at more regulation, I guess. What's the upside? That's sort of the Debbie Downer view of net neutrality. Is there an upside to this? Let's start with you, Amos.
The upside that is touted is that if we allow the economic course to take its course, I guess. Mm-hmm. That if we have a broadband provider who is getting paid for some of these, from some of these websites or from some of these services, they're using up their bandwidth. That it's that provider is going to automatically improve your service. They're going to deploy more infrastructure faster because they've got more money and this is a profit making thing for them, and that in theory the edge users are going to be treated fairly. That's really the argument, is it's going to spur more growth because there's more economic incentive for them to do that. That economic incentive, that payment that happens there, is going to be passed along to somebody, and generally we'll see that as an end user in our internet service too. So I err on the side of letting it letting it go, letting it be free the way it is today, or the way it has been, not doing the additional charges for the additional bandwidth from the additional services. But, you know, there's certainly the differing opinion.
Okay. Jeff, you have an opinion on that? I take it no. Either that or we lost Jeff. That, either
sorry,
one
there's, yep. there's actually some construction in the background, so
yeah.
I've been trying to keep everything on mute. But, yes, the problem is a lot of this stuff has it played out. Even when there was no net neutrality, very few of these kind of scenarios were playing out that way, i.e., you know, except for maybe Netflix having to pay for some of the extra stuff. There is a good example that some people are pointing out called the Facebook thing that Facebook is doing in third world countries, where they are giving people internet access free but only to certain websites. And some of the people behind this think that program could go that if websites pay ISPs, then to make it free for people, poor people could actually get internet access and get access maybe to a subset of the internet that's subsidized by sites paying back to ISPs and stuff. But, you know, even the Facebook stuff is fairly new in the developing countries and stuff. We'll see how it all goes out. This is one of those things that I really, only time will really tell which way or another. I'm more concerned that if this becomes a failed experiment, that we cannot reverse it because the Congress passed a law saying you can never reverse this again. So I'd rather have the FCC be able to try both ways and see how it works out in the end than to, you know, lock it in, so to speak, like they're trying to do now.
Is that even legal? I'm not an expert in law, but I don't think a sitting government body can encumber or limit the future dealings of a future government body, I didn't think.
Yes. The only stipulation is Congress itself cannot limit a future Congress. That is the only thing that they cannot pass a law. So a law through the Constitution cannot limit a new Congress that comes in and wants to repass a law. But as you know, passing any legislation right now is very, very hard. So once the law is in place, it basically, because the FCC gets their authority from Congress and the law, the laws are going to tell the FCC you can't do that anymore, and that limits them. It's going to take a humongous effort to, you know, redo that law, because you'd have to pass another law through Congress. So it's not set in stone, but it's a much harder hurdle in the future to be able to redo it, because you're going to have majority support in Congress and the will to push it through Congress.
And things are a little messy right now over towards that end of the coast. And yeah, this will the ability to get really anything done is going to be interesting. That's why this public comment period that the FCC is going into seems to be a really good thing for me. It kind of slows the timeline down a little bit and asks people for their opinions. And I guess we'd encourage the folks one way or the other to express their comments once that comment period opens up with the FCC. And if you have strong feelings with one way or the other with your congresspeople, let them know, too. We certainly encourage that on the program. And we encourage you to get a hold of us today. In the moment at stpb.org is our email address. 956-STPB is the text number. That's 956-7372. Just a few more minutes in the show to get to some, I guess, some product news. Have you folks been following? Google has had a series of things out, improvements to some of their software programs that I know and love, so some of the photo editing programs. And I'm not real that thrilled about the change from Picasso over to Photos, but I understand that they're trying to take the photo process, I guess, through mobile, or more tightly integrate it with the mobile product. But have you gentlemen? There's been a number of different Google announcements in the last couple of weeks. Has anything come across your desk you've really been excited about? Start with you, Joel. Jeff. I'm sorry. A lot of J's today. Jeff, Have you seen anything with the Google products that have come along?
I'm a big Google user. I'm not super excited at this point. One of the things with new Google products is I always take a little bit of wait and see stuff because they burnt me in the past with me using stuff and then they discontinued it. But saying that, you know, if it fits a niche and it serves a function, sooner or later I'll start using it and probably really like it because they do tend to have very well thought out products when they actually do release them. So, but you always have to be a little bit careful, especially nowadays. Google tends to, within a year, oh, that wasn't making enough money, it's gone, overnight kind of thing, and then you're kind of left hanging. So kind of like I was with Google Reader back in the day. So a little hesitant, but we'll see how it all plays out in the end. I always give them a little bit of bacon time. I do not like to be bleeding edge. I like to be leading edge, but not bleeding edge, and that means, you know, 6 months is an easy wait before you, you know, you invest in anything. So,
do you think Mac or iOS users or iPhone users are going to try the Google Assistant on their platform over Siri?
To be honest, I'm going to go back to kind of this interesting thing back in video games that all the video game manufacturers found out is that if it doesn't come with the base system, or if it comes with the base system, no one ever buys an add-on. And I should say nobody, but you're talking about 2% of your entire customer base. So once something's built in, like Siri, most people are never going to change it out. Windows, Microsoft kind of found that with Cortana, trying to release it on Android stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Android always had Google, you know, Voice and stuff like that. Once the product's in, baked in, the chances of anyone downloading something else, I mean the massive user base, not the techie people, is pretty much zero. So, you know, I don't really think so because they already have products that do the same thing built in, and they will live with those products even if they're bad, unless it gets super, super bad, and the pain threshold gets very, very high. But most people outside of the tech industry itself are not going to change of if something's built in, that's what they use it once, they get used to it, and that's what they're going to use as long as they have that device.
Interesting, interesting. Yeah, good point. Amos, have you messed around with the Google Lens yet?
I have not.
Yeah, it looks interestingly enough like something that could be usable. It offers a clear view of what it examines what you're looking at and can explain what's going on in your photos to, you know, what kind of a flower that is or a butterfly or something like that. But I think it's got more far-reaching implications in it than we can get to on the show because I hear the piano music playing and we're about to be escorted off stage. So maybe that's a topic for another program, perhaps June 2nd. The next tech radio for folks, but anyway, a lot of announcements. We didn't have time to get to them today, and then there was some Mac news as well. We'll get to that next time with Joel on the next program. So anyway, gentlemen, thank you for your time. It was a great discussion today. Have a great weekend, everybody.